Good morning, Boker Tov, to everybody. Welcome. It's always nice to see everybody, and of course to have my parents here as well. They'll be off to Netanya soon, so they'll be popping in every now and then, but in the meantime, it's great to have them here. We have two dedications, very special dedications for today's shiur. First of all, I've been asked to announce that the shiur is sponsored today in memory of Mordechai ben Avraham, Zecher Livracha. I don't know who sponsored it, but the sponsorship is very welcome. Zecher Livracha, Mordechai ben Avraham, should be an Ilui Neshama for him. I also have another announcement, and I do know who gave me this announcement. This comes from Miriam Marcus here, who's asked me to announce that the shiur is dedicated to the memory of her grandparents, Miriam, who she's named after, Bat Shlomo, and Yeshua Tzvi ben Yitzchak, and also to her half-brother, Asher Chaim Shmuel ben Mordechai, all of whom were tragically murdered in the Shoah by the Nazis in Lublin. And today is their Yahrzeit, the 5th of Cheshvan, Tach Shin, 1939, and therefore it's definitely appropriate for us to also learn Le'ilu Nishmatam. They should have an Ilu Neshama, we should learn well, and I appreciate that. Any dedications of that nation, of course, sponsorship for the OU is always welcome and appreciated. Now, we started last week on the very tricky, painful, but important subject of disgraced rabbis, and we asked a lot of questions, and we didn't answer them all yet. There are questions which we left outstanding, and I would like to try and get to them today. Let's just summarize, though, for the benefit of people who were not here last week, or even who were here last week and don't remember what happened last week, or even yesterday afternoon, what we said last week. We raised the question of what to do with the Torah, ongoing and past, of rabbis who have fallen short, often very far short, of the high levels of expectation of behavior that we have for them. And we said, and it's important to stress, that the vast majority of people that we know, rabbis and non-rabbis, are good people who live up to what's expected of them. But some people do not. And when these people are disgraced, what do we do with their Torah? And we said basically last time we saw three basic issues. We saw a Gemara in Moed Katan which said that if your Rav is like a malach, if your teacher is like an angel, then mevakesh Torah mipihu, then you can go to that kind of person for Torah. But if they are not like an angel, then do not go to them. They learned that from a pasuk in Malachi, Fisei Kohen, Yishmeru Daf, etc. And we saw last week, what is the definition of an angel? Who is an angel? None of us are angels. Every person in the world has averas. There's no question about that. And we said, no, you don't have to be angelic and perfect. But once a person engages in behavior which is either a chilul Hashem or which is embarrassing to their rabbinic colleagues, whatever definition that has, that's behavior which is totally unbecoming. And we said, of course, there are different kinds of behavior. I'm not going through it all now, but one has to understand that when that happens, one cannot, in principle, learn Torah from such a person. And then we raised the Gemara in Chagiga, which is the story of Elisha ben Avuya. And we said that Rabbi Meir was a loyal student to Elisha ben Avuya, even after he became a world-renowned, infamous heretic. And we saw the story of Elisha ben Avuya on the horse, riding on Shabbos, breaking Shabbos, and Rabbi Meir learning Torah from him. And the Gemara there asked, how could this be? Didn't we just say you have to be a malach? Rabbi Elisha ben Avuya was no malach. How could Rabbi Meir learn Torah? And what do we answer? We said, oh, Rabbi Meir can filter. He was able to filter, he could take out the rind, he could take out the bad stuff and throw it away, and the good stuff he could keep and process. And the Gemara said, but doesn't it say you have to be a malach? And the Gemara resolved there, ha begadol, v'ha bekatan. If the student is a gadol, then they can filter, like Rabbi Meir. If the student is a katan, and again we're not talking about adults and children, we're talking about ability and experience, then the student can't filter if they're a katan. And we saw then the Rambam and the Shulchan Aruch rule this prohibition of learning from a rabbi who is inappropriate, and they never mention any distinction between gadol or katan. And we gave a couple of answers, and we said, well, maybe they hold that nobody's allowed, the gadol or katan. And we said, no, that can't be, because the Rambam himself learns from Aristotle, from others, we'll see his own, the Rambam's quote today. And we concluded that it could be that the Rambam and the Shulchan Aruch and the other poskim, they're basically telling us, We can't regard ourselves as able to filter in this way, and presumably we are in the definition of katan, and we're not able to do that. And we'll see a little bit more today whether that applies to all things. We'll raise the question today of written works, etc. And finally, last week we said that even if a person misbehaves, and behaves very badly, we cannot base that on unsubstantiated rumors. And that's a very, very important thing. There has to be ascertained evidence of some kind. I'm not getting into what that would be, but there has to be some reality to the allegations and not just allegations. What did we not deal with last week? We didn't raise the question of, or we raised the question, but we didn't answer, what about written works? Do I really have to take them off the shelf? As I mentioned last week, I have quite a few books on my shelves. I can think of three or four of them now from rabbis who at the time were renowned, but now have fallen far from grace. And the question is, do I need to then just put them in Geniza, or maybe even just throw them in the garbage, or keep them in the restricted section of the library, which I have one of those just at the back of my office, or do I just say, no, leave it in the lounge, it's fine, you know. When he wrote this book, he was a renowned, accepted rabbi, and what happened after is to say that's after, I don't have anything that he did after. Or do we say, no, it has to be taken away? That's one question. A second question which we need to raise today is, what happens when the rabbi does tshuva? How do we know when someone's done tshuva? Can we reinstate them? Should they be put back into their position as Rosh Hashiva after they've come out of jail for whatever? This, of course, is a live question in this country. We have people who are in and out of various different institutions, as they used to say, in my own country, at Her Majesty's pleasure. Then return to positions of influence and power. Some may consider this to be Chilul Hashem. Others may say, well, there's such a thing as tshuva. If the person did bad things and then they regret it and they don't do bad things anymore, then why shouldn't they get a second chance? We'll see. We'll see what the sources have to say about that. And then at the very end, we'll look at some contemporary rulings. We have some very interesting statements by Rav Heschel Schechter, by Mordechai Willig, and by others, and we'll see how we can get on with that. So let's start from the very beginning. Why? Why is there a problem of learning from disgraced rabbis? What are we concerned about? What's going to happen to me if I pick up the book and read it? So let's have a look at number one in Tosfos. Tosfos in Chagiga. When the Gemara there says Rebbe Meir could do it because he was able, Habagadol v'Habakatan, Tosfos jump in there and say as follows. Number one, the Hadarish Peirik Basra Demait Cotton the Havasanu Shmuei the Shmaita Rav Yehuda. So it's a Shamte Rav Yehuda. Don't we say there that the rabbi who was misbehaving in Moed Cotton and Rav Yehuda put him in Cherem? That's it. He took him off the shelves for everybody. He didn't say some people can, some people can't. Why did he not make this distinction between Gadol and Katan? So Tosfos says, Ikala Meimah de Katanim Havu. The people that were going to learn from this rabbi, the concern there, they were effectively in this category of Katanim. The Garsi Kameh, they were the one who were learning in front of him. And here's the key. The Chayshinan, and we're worried, Dilma Mim Shati. Maybe they'll be drawn after them. Maybe they'll be influenced by them. Maybe they'll be victims of them. Maybe they'll become heretical like them, whatever the behavior was. So according to Tosfos, the concern is negative influence on the person who is learning. The Torah may still be good Torah. It may be accurate Torah. But we're worried if you have a connection with this rabbi because of what they've done in the past, this may be dangerous for you in some way. So if that's the reason, then maybe it depends. Maybe it depends on the subject matter. Maybe if this rabbi was found guilty of a certain area of misbehavior, but he wrote on a completely different issue, maybe that's got nothing to do with it. For example, if he was found to have stolen money, but then he gives beautiful Divrei Torah on the Parsha, what are we worried that I might get dragged into? Meaning, if he stole money and was found guilty, and then I'm reading his Sforim on business ethics, okay, so then I understand that how can I, maybe I'll get dragged into his way of business ethics. But if I'm reading beautiful ideas on Parshas Lech Lecha, then, ma kesher. So maybe we could ask that. Also, what if there's no personal contact? What if I'm just reading a book? I don't have a personal contact. I listen to a shir on the web. I pick up a book off the shelf. Is that different from if I sit in front of them and learn from them and meet them for coffee and go to their house for Shabbos? Maybe the concern is if I have a personal contact. That's the second question. And also, what's the nature of me? I mean, it goes back to this issue. Maybe I can deal with reading in this book, even though we said we're all Katanim these days. Maybe if I'm just picking a book off the shelf, maybe I can be more discerning than if I would be fall into the, if you like, the charismatic pull of some guru rabbi. And this happens, unfortunately. There are people who pull people into the charisma, and they're unable to pull themselves away. Maybe just reading a book is different because of the nature of the relationship. So there are some, like Tosfos, who seem to say the problem is I'll be sucked in. Others say no. The Altar of Kelm, I didn't bring you the whole source, but he's absolutely clear, and he bases this on the teachings of Rabbi Yisrael Salanter. He says, if the teacher has an unrefined character as defined, obviously nobody's perfect like we said, but if they fall into this category that we can't learn from them, that's it. He says, Ein Torato Torah Klau. I don't care what they say, it is not Torah. It's not Torah. There's no point learning it. It's wrong to learn it. It's just not Torah at all. There is simply no benefit in learning anything that they said, because, and there's only danger involved. And Rav Moshe, actually, in the Tshuva, also discusses whether a conservative rabbi should be asked to give shiurim in the shul. And one of the things he says there, he says, first of all, we're obviously worried that he may say things which are actually incorrect, which are based on conservative theology, system, whatever, which are not acceptable. But even if he says something which is correct, he draws an inference from the Gemara there. Remember, the Gemara Moed Katan says, what can we do? This rabbi is needed by the community. Should we put him in Chayram? Since from the fact that you see the rabbi was needed, you see that his Torah was good Torah. But still they put him in Chayram. Says Rav Moshe, I don't care. If the rabbi has misbehaved, even if the Torah is good Torah, in theory, we're worried there'll be a slight nuance, the way he speaks about Chazal, the way he speaks about something. He says the Torah is just, in principle, not Ein Torah, the Torah Klal, you can't learn it. So that is one distinction, and that will impact on the question of writing. Look over the page on page 2. Which way are we going to jump on this? Are we going to say that we're worried by influence, or are we going to say that the Torah is intrinsically invalid? You see, there's a chakira there. There's a difference the way we look at it, and one of the implications could be in books. Let's have a look. This is the writings of Rav Yirmiyahu Lau from Arabia, a less known rabbi, but he says a very interesting thing here. Number 2. Amnam, Yiksha Ma'oid Rabbeinu Morin Avuchim. He asked a question on the Rambam in Morin Avuchim, who quotes from all sorts of places. V'nira Shalama B'Sifrei Chachmei Akum. He learns from many what some would regard as illegitimate non-Jewish sources. Uberoi Sifrei Sham. And at the beginning of his Sefer, and he quotes the very pasuk, the very verse that Rabbi Meir chose to justify learning from Elisha ben Avuya. The Rambam chooses that verse as well. How can he do that? Aisha. Umipi Avi Moiri Rabbi. He says, he quotes his father, Hagon. He brings a distinction. Yesh lechalek. We can distinguish bein limud mipiv shel Rasha le limud mitoch sefer mimenu. He says, I think you can make a distinction. The Gemara was most concerned about having a relationship, a direct personal relationship with someone who's gone off. But reading a book, he says, that's not the same. That's less of a concern. Do me talk safer, because when you're reading a book, Adam Gadol Yesh Livro HaToyv Meharach, it's easy for someone who's able, again, you have to be qualified, to distinguish between good and bad. Aval mipiv, like I said before, from their actual personal relationship, shechibur im Rasha, you're having this connection with the Rasha, Ra, this evil person, v'gorem Ra v'hashchatala Adam. That could have a suck you in and cause problems. The Daike says, and you can make a deal, you can see carefully in the words, im harav, if the Rav is like a malach, yivachesh Torah, what does it say? Mipihu. That's what it said in the Gemara. If the Rav is like a malach, seek Torah from his teeth, from his mouth. The im lav al yivachesh Torah mipi, but if not, don't seek from his mouth. You see it's from his mouth. Mipihu means one-on-one. Vu Gemara Macha, Rabbi Meir, and also asked him, Rabbi Meir, heichi lamed mipume de acher. How did he learn from the mouth of acher? And therefore he draws this distinction, but zeh yesh li yashiv dav, v'derech Rabbeinu, and this is how you can justify the Rambam, Shiyada Banasha, because he was able, the Kiyim Le Libro Ha'oichel Mitoch Apsolis Misifrei. The Rambam never learned from Aristotle directly, and as far as I'm aware, he never learned from any of the Islamic philosophers directly. He learned from their books, and therefore you can see from here that it could be that the book is less of a concern than the person themselves, which is maybe part of the justification why people do have books on their shelves of all sorts of people. Okay? well-known characters. It's interesting. I go to the YU forum sale whenever I can. I mean, I wouldn't get on a plane especially to go to America to go there, although actually I would, but don't tell my wife that. But I'm usually there anyway, and there's a table there called Academic Interest. It's an amazing forum set. If you ever get a chance to go to YU in February, it's just gigantic as a forum set. It's fantastic. And there's a table called Academic Interest, which is always the most interesting table. Okay. I would tell my students, depending on what kind of a shidduch you're looking for, because it's a real theme, the YU forum set. Okay? The guys from YU, the girls from Stern, I say to them, depending on what kind of guy you want to be, you hang around the Art Scrolls forum, or you hang around the academic table, or you hang out there. That's how it works. Because different people are at different tables. So I see books on the academic interest table of people that, I don't know, I'm not mentioning any names, but as an Englishman, these people are well known to have been out in a very clear way. And they're there in the YU academic sale. So maybe books in that sense are seen differently from the individuals themselves. Rav Vosner wants nothing of it. He says, I absolutely disagree with this. He comes and says, no, I don't care if it's a book of individual number three. K'moy sha'amru chazal da'asa lilmoy Torah mi-rav, she'enu hagon, kach asur lilmod Torah she'nichtav. So too, it's exactly the same. You can't learn Torah which is written, or nitfas, which is printed, mi-mi she'enu hagon she'blit safek. Forget it. Without any question, it'll have an effect. Don't start playing around with books. The books have to come off the shelves. You're not allowed to read from the books either. So you see already there's a machlokes between different approaches as to whether a book is going to be as problematic as a rav. Some say it is. Some say it is not. There is another Gemara we didn't see last week in number four, which takes us into a slightly different area as well, which is maybe the problem with the Torah of someone who has been disgraced is it's inappropriate that we raise their name and quote their Torah because it's not kavod for the Torah to quote them in that name, because that name is now a disgraced name. Maybe we're more worried about the issue of the Kavod HaTorah. So the Gemara quotes here, Ibu in number four. Ibu was a rabbi, okay, he was called Ibu. Ibu had a manchit, the achil pat avi mitzri, pat avi mitzri. Ibu used to eat bread which was made by non-Jews. Do you see non-kosher bread? Bread has to be made by Jews. I'm not getting into a whole discussion of the halachas of Pas Akum and Pas Palta and all of that kind of stuff. He used to eat from rabbinically prohibited bread. So they made it, and he was a Rav. Amar lehu Rava. Rava made a statement to the student. Ve'item Rav Nachman by Yitzchak, and maybe it was Rav Nachman by Yitzchak. Loi tishtu'u minei de Ibu. We are not allowed to quote this man Ibu anymore. De ka'achel lachmad aramoi. Because he eats non-kosher bread. He may no longer be quoted in the Beit Midrash because it's been discovered that he doesn't keep halacha. Why? Why? What's going to happen to you if you quote the Torah of this man Ibu who's been found with a sneaky, bread roll from the non-Jewish bakery? Okay, he did another error, there's no question, but what's wrong with the Torah? Am I going to get dragged into behavior of that nature? So the Ritzvah says, no, in this case it's not about the behavior. It's about him. Look at number five. Lo tishtu minei b'ibu, peusha ha-go'inim. The go'inim explain the following. Lo taskiu shmu mishmo b'Bet Midrash. We don't want his name mentioned anymore in the Bet Midrash. V'achidaita lishna loimah. To midi keneged midi. This is midi keneged midi. This is an appropriate equal and opposite reaction. Ki hu mazalzel divrei chachamim. He doesn't take the rabbinic Torah seriously. He says he's played fast and loose with rabbinic prohibitions. And therefore, tekanaseim, and their takanas, well, achein, ein makalsim dvarav bebeit ha-medrash. Therefore, midi keneged midi, his name shouldn't be quoted alongside those very people that he disgraces because we don't want his name in the Beit Midrash. So, okay. So then the question is, well, that's his name. Can I just quote his Torah and just don't mention his name? And the answer may be, okay, in some cases, yes, you may be able to. Look at number six. The Chatan Sofer has a, Rav Chaim Sofer, who is Shalish and Shuvah's Minchas Chaim, okay, he quotes the following idea. Number six. Mashma she'ibu hayachacham. It sounds from this Gemara that Ibu was actually a legitimate chacham. Because he wasn't noig al pichachon, the oida al gezeres based in, and he went against the gezeres of the rabbis. Einu nechshav kachacham. We don't want to regard him as a chacham. Lomar davar shmur bishmo. We don't want to say something in his name. But kalvachomer, then benosha kalvachomer shelo lomar davar shmur mipi ish shehu mikaf chadashim. Okay, or mechadshim, I think you could probably say she'ovrim al kama gedolim b'siyagim. He's worried about the reform. His concern is, what if the reform rabbi comes up with a geshmak adal dvar Torah? Okay, what happens? Can we quote that? Can we? And he says, you know something, we can't quote any such person by name. That's for sure not. Ach mikol makam nirishem mutalama gufadava b'shem ish sheloy leikashmoy. You can quote the Torah, but just not the name. Just say, I heard in the name of one person, one rabbi, one an Adam God, or whatever. You can say what you like, but just don't quote the name. V'chein mashma loshen Rashba, and he quotes the Rashba, Ya'an she'ein anoig al tichachamim, which is based on this Ibu Gemara, since he didn't act properly according to the rabbis, v'oida al gzeres based in, ein anachshav kachacham lo medav shmu b'shmo. You can't say it in his name. Hainu, shelo lahat kishmo sheyia zeichet tzadik libracha. What does zeichet tzadik libracha mean? When you mention a tzadik, it brings bracha into the world. Lahat karat shmoi, al torato. Aval keivan sheomer shamati mi'ish echad. If you just say I heard from one person, hagam shelo yahava sheomer dava b'shem amru she'enu mat kishmoi kamoi ba'ed b'sha'amah b'shem Mordechai, lahavigula ba'olam. Everybody knows the famous Gemara, if you say something in the name of somebody else, if you mention their name, just like Esther, when she brought the whole from in the name of Mordechai, the big Tanan Teresh, etc., you bring Geula to the world. That brought about ultimately the salvation of the Jewish people because Mordechai was elevated, etc. And therefore, whenever you hear Torah, you should always say the name. And the Gemara is very particular about this. It says this one said in the name of that one, in the name of that one, in the name of that one. Sometimes you have four or five lines of people just quoting other people who it was, which if you do Daf Yomi is a big relief sometimes. You just have four lines of people who quoted other people. If you do Daf Yomi, you know what I'm talking about, okay? He says, even though you lose out on that, al kopanim einu mitlabesh b'talit shel acherim. You don't have to worry that you're plagiarizing. You're not dressing in other people's clothes. The einu aver al lo tigzol. No, you're not stealing from the poor. Right? I'm a kach shamati mipi ish echad. You should just say, I heard once from someone the following idea. And I'm sure a lot of people do this. Whenever you hear a rabbi say, I heard once the following idea, I'm always now fascinated, who did you hear that from? You know, the local imam, you know, etc. Who was it? And so there is a kind of Torah from certain kinds of people that is quotable, but just not in the name of the people. It's a different kind of problem. We're not worried you're going to get influenced. And the Rambam is very clear about this, and he's very open about it. Look at number 7. Vada, at the beginning of Shemana Prakim, he had very much the things I'm going to tell you here, uba mashi yavim in aperish, my commentary on the Mishnah. I didn't make any of this up. Don't think I made any of this up. I'm not just inventing things. These are all gathered from wide sources, the Midrashot, uba Talmud, the Zulakom, Mechibu Reim, from the works of Chazal. And I'm going to bring you from the philosophers, Hakadumim, from the Greek philosophers, Hachadashim, from the Islamic philosophers, Avicenna, and all these people who the Rambam looked to for interesting philosophical ideas. I will quote from so many people, and he comes out with his famous line, Ushma ha'emet mimi she'amra. If it's true, it's true. I don't care who said it. If it's a true idea, and here he's not worried you're going to get pulled after these individuals, say the truth from whoever said it. And then he says, but you know something? Some people will get upset. It's never been any different. There have always been people around Kanaim, people who are zealots, who will get all upset when you quote this one or that one or the other one. I don't want to hear from him. He's a Zionist. He's a non-Zionist. Whatever it is. The Eshel Fa'amim Sheshem Ha'ishahu Yachnis Belev Misha'enu Tfunah. But in the minds of people who are not really intelligent or discerning, if you mention certain names, people will think shezeh hadava nisad, as if to say that just because this person said it, that makes it a bad idea. So what's my advice to you, says the Rambam? Yesh, the yesh bo tochra, okay, shalo yadehu, and people will accuse you that since this man said it and he wasn't religious or he wasn't Jewish, it can't be good. He gives you a piece of advice. Mitnei zera iti shelo lizkor ha'omer. So then I just miss out the person who mentioned it. I just say the idea. Hoyo v'kavanasi shetusag ha'to'elet likro. What I want you to do is get the most out of the learning. I want you to benefit. If I have to quote anonymously, I'll quote anonymously. Fine. But I'm not going to miss out on the Torah just because someone said it that is not according to your particular hashkafic concerns. I'll never forget when I had my first American chavrusa. So this was an experience for me in many different ways. I'm from England, and I used to only learn with English people. And then I ended up in a kollel here in America. Apart from the fact that all the guys in the kollel were American, and everyone kept coming up to me and slapping me on the back and putting my shoulders and giving me massages. And I'm saying, like, leave me alone. Like, I'm English. I need my personal space. And I don't like it when people touch me all the time. That leaving aside that, which I got used to after a while because, you know, everyone's touchy-feely. So I got out of Chumash to start using, and he turned around to me with horror. He said, "You can't use that." So I said, "Why ever not?" So he said, "It's a conservative Chumash." I said, "It is not. It's the Hertz Chumash. And we use the Hertz Chumash. This is Rabbi Hertz." He said, "Hertz, not Hirsch, Hertz. Okay, Joseph Hertz. The chief rabbi of England from 1911 to 1947, whatever it was, and he wrote the famous Hertz Chumash." So I said, "Why would you think this was a conservative Chumash?" He said, "Well, just open it." He quotes from priests, he quotes from academics, he quotes from everyone. And if I'm not mistaken, I didn't check it, Hertz himself in the introduction brings this Rambam and says, "Shema ha'emet, mimi she'amra." I don't care if the right Reverend William Albright or whatever his name was has a brilliant idea, then I'll quote that idea as well. But to some people this is not acceptable. And the Rambam knew that as well, and you can't quote these people. Obviously, if you open up other Chumashim, which are more on sale now, the Hertz Chumash has been disappearing gradually from the shelves of even in England and being replaced by other Chumashim where the people who are quoted are more generally accepted around the Shabbos table. But it's basically this machloikas that's going on. So again, there's a certain kind of Torah from people who were not really worried about you being drawn after them, but the problem is mentioning their name. And then you have to decide who your customers are, whether you can mention it or not mention it as appropriate. Now, let's go on. I want to raise something now, which I think you'll find fascinating, which is Rav Moshe has a tshuva about a rabbi who's gone off. In his opinion, anyway, we'll see, you'll know who this is when we start reading it. And this is from 1959. This is a long, long time ago. And he wants to know, is there a problem using Torah from before they went off? Okay? And he's going to conclude that that's less of a problem, even though that rabbi now is completely unacceptable. So whoever it might be. So let's have a look now on page number 3, 8. He's asked the Shaila in 1959 about a certain person. Badavar nigunim. There are certain songs you already know who this tshuva is about. Okay? In 1959. Sha'asa Adam Kasha. A very respectable person. Sha'achazman nitkaltel. And after a while, he went off. And we'll see how Rav Moshe in 1959 regards what is unacceptable behavior. V'sanish mu'ane. And now his teachings are no longer accepted. Im yesh lenagnam. Okay? Al chatunot. Are you allowed to sing his songs at chasnas and play them, etc.? These nigunim have these songs played. And this is in ER 1959. And he answers the following. Let's look at this inside in some detail because I think you'll find it instructive. The Dama Echad Shehaya Bar Torah Becheskas Kashrus. This person had Torah and he was presumed to be a upright, valid individual. Kamashanim for many years. Behumen Agay. And he's a musician. Sha'asa nigunim, and he's a songwriter. Ashiri Kodesh, he writes lots of songs based on psukim. Ula shir la chatunot, and he writes songs for weddings. V'hurgulu kam b'nei Torah, the zamer otam b'smachot, shal mitzvah. And many people already in 1959 were singing these songs and all over the place. I actually have a funny story about that, but I can't tell it now. Okay. Fine. Maybe at the end if I have time. So now he says, Va'ata, ein shmu ata tova, and now this person, he says, has a bad name. And he recalls what the bad name is. Shemachnis bachurim ubutulot yachad. He had mixed
audiences, which again in Rav Moshe's circles was not acceptable, and he gets men and women together, and he plays music in front of mixed crowds, which clearly other people would say this was not unacceptable and this was required and necessary. I'm not getting into that discussion now. But Shoyal, and you're asking me, in Musa after the Zama Benigunav, am I allowed to sing any more of these songs? Sha'asa Tchile, which he wrote before Kishehai Vecheskes Kashrus. The songs he wrote before he started playing to mixed crowds. Are you allowed to still sing these songs? Not all mixed. Most, well, yes and no. Most, mixed seating at weddings, I understand. But most Choshev Tamid Chachomim who learnt in the Beit Yeshivas, like the person he's talking about here, did not go on to play music and have concerts in front of me. That was not a normal thing that regular Tamid Chachomim did. Even in those days, they had lots of mixed this and mixed that, but this was a very unusual person, as we all know, and did things that other people wouldn't or couldn't do. So, the Rav Moshe's answer is as follows. Lefiani Asaiti. Eini Roi B'zeh Shum Issa. I don't think it's a problem at all. And look at why. Anything that was done when the person involved, and this is how this is being expanded, if you like, to other areas, anything that was done when the person involved was still valid and on the right path, whatever that was, that's fine, even if they went off later. Varaya, and I bring you a proof. Yochanan Kohen Gadol was a major individual who became a tzaddiki at the end of his life. Okay? Even though he was in his late 80s, 90s, he went off. You never know. Until the very end, anything's possible with people. Okay? With all of us. Matina Takanas Yochanan Kohen Gadol. Shenikru al Shmo, things are quoted in his name. The Yeshua Tavrin, who Zesh Shimush, okay, Shmoinim Shanaba Kohen Gadol. And he is the very one, according to many, who served for 80 years as the Kohen Gadol, Ulubatok Nasa Suki. It doesn't stop us from quoting Yochanan Kohen Gadol now, the fact that he, at the end of his life, became a tzaddiki, because what we're quoting from is the stuff that he wrote before he became a tzaddiki, before he became a Sadducee. So that's number one. He thinks I'm less concerned about quoting stuff from before. Ulevad, and apart from that, ulevad that, hamuchruch came the hakala makor le'issa hu letama Rambam, the concern is the he brings a Rambam in Sifrei, in Hilchot Sefer Torah, that if a heretic writes a Sefer Torah, even writes a Sefer Torah properly, fully, with all the shamus, with the God's name and everything, a Sefer Torah written by a heretic. So what should you do with that? Sheyisarech. It has to be burnt. He says, that's the halacha. That even if it has the Shem Hashem with Yud Kei Vav Kei, if the Sefer Torah is written by a heretic, it has no kedusha, it has to be whole thing burnt. Because we don't want the works of heretics to have an ongoing stature. But what if this individual became a heretic after they wrote the Sefer Torah? He kasherim mamash afli krovah. The Sefer Torah they wrote when they were not a heretic is absolutely fine. God forbid you'd burn that Sefer Torah. You refund that Sefer Torah in shul. A Sefer Torah they wrote after they became a heretic, that's a problem. That has to be burnt. But says Rav Moshe, even a Sefer Torah, he's going to say all the more so, nigunim, which are not really a problem at all, but what was written before and what was done before is not a concern, he says, or much less of a concern. Zehine, bo'ov dezodah ha'zehet nishmu'aneh. In this case you're bringing up where this person went off later. Eina b'inyani k'fira, and even when you say they went off, the songwriter he's talking about, is not a heretic, he says. He, as far as Rav Moshe is concerned, was involved in inappropriate mixed singing. Having mixed crowds in a concert. God forbid, he said, we'd say to somebody, just because they did one thing, or even a bad thing that you don't like, that everyone's an apikiris. Rav Moshe was not happy to just call everybody a heretic, left, right, and center. He's not even going off in a very conscious way in other areas. The harak ledavar echad, the kalas rosh, or priests in one specific area, there's a problem. Who are varyan? He's committing this aver l'teavon. Yisabesh al adam kazeh ein l'neilav sheyiyeh din v'chiyuv shelo lahaniyav shem lo lamasa. There's no, we have no concept with a person of this nature that you cannot quote them or you cannot sing their songs of this nature. Adarabba, who borrows our Sefer Torah, Yichtav Ish Kazeh, if this person were to write a Sefer Torah, even now, he says, Yeh Kosher, So you can't just tar everybody with the same brush in every way. And at the end, he says, "The imkain kol shekain ani gunim she'oitzer shereshayim lenagin." All the more so when it comes to songs which he writes, you're allowed to sing songs. Ve'ein lahachmer, af lebnei tayru bali nefesh. Even people who want to be machmer, the songs are fine. Ve'im tani shmuni gamli inyani kfira as hu kedikim. If he would be a heretic, that's a different thing. She'ilu she'af lebitchila ein mokum lahachmer klal. But he says, even if he were to go be a heretic, I'm not sure the nigunim would be a problem. Which is very interesting, because there are all sorts of different crowds that sing songs from all sorts of places. What brought to mind here was the famous Havdalah, which was written by Debbie Friedman. You know, that the Havdalah songs that people sing at the end of Havdalah. There's a very famous Havdalah that she wrote, with which she was a Reform rabbi. And a lot of people in a lot of different crowds sing her nigun for Havdalah, which is a very beautiful nigun at the end of Havdalah, especially in youth groups and crowds. But even in Orthodox circles, Rav Moshe says, really, I'm not too worried about nigunim. They're not the same as svarim in this way. And even songs, he says, even this individual, even songs he wrote afterwards, I'm not sure that's a problem either. They're not really like svarim. Maybe not play them for certain people who want to be machmir. But bottom line, What did Rav Moshe say here? Rav Moshe said that we're much less concerned with things that came before than with things that came after. All the more so with Nigunim, but even with Sforim as well. And therefore, there are those who wish to say, based on this Rav Moshe, that things which were written before are less of a problem. And this is a big, has many practical applications, as I mentioned before. I said last week that I had a reference on my website to another website of an individual that wrote amazing Divrei Torah and very important contributions that other people had not made. And I was taken to task by a young lady who emailed me and said, how can you have this man's email, have this man's website, the website's still up there, when certain rabbis have said that women are not allowed to learn from his Torah? Because he was caught up in a very, very major scandal, and proved to be, it really happened this way, that he was involved in inappropriate relationships with women. And a psak was made that women may not speak to him, learn from him, or even learn his Torah. So what should I do? This Torah is Torah which helps a lot of people, but certain rabbis say that women should not learn his Torah. So I actually didn't know what to do. I didn't know whether to take it down. I didn't know whether to leave it up. What I did in the end, I don't know if this is the right thing, what I did in the end was I put a little star next to this on the list and said, at the bottom, before learning this Torah, a shayla should be asked to an appropriate authority. Maybe that was a total cop-out. I'm sorry. Just don't ask me. For men only. I don't want to write for men only. I thought this was the most delicate way of dealing with it, because there really is a debate about this, and there was no clear ruling that this Torah is now unacceptable, because it is immensely helpful to a number of people who've become much more learned through learning it. But this particular rabbi was found to be a very unacceptable individual in the way he behaved. Fine, let's move on to a new topic. What about afterwards? We talked about before. What about after someone does tshuva? So the Rambam writes, "V'chein Rav number 9, Harav she'ena holech b'derech tova." A rabbi who misbehaves badly. Afal pisha chacham gadol, who is a great rabbi, but kol ha'am tzrichin lo, even though people need him, ein mitlamdim mimenu. You can't learn from him now going forward. Ad shuvu lemutam. Until he becomes does tshuva. How do you know? How do you know if he's done tshuva? The Rambam seems to say that if he does tshuva, okay, then you can pick it up where you went. We all would like to think that tshuva is an acceptable solution for us. We would like people to accept our tshuva when we misbehave. When is it acceptable for the rabbi? And the Shulchan Aruch brings it down in pretty much the same wording, ad shiachzor lemutar. When do you know someone has done tshuva? So I brought you a fascinating machlokas between the Shach and the Rabbi Yonatan Eibershitz. The Ramah paskens in Shulchan Aruch in number 11. Meshumad. What about a meshumad? Somebody who has converted to Christianity. And now they said, I'm sorry, I did the wrong thing. This through history has been a very common occurrence, okay? At what point do we say, you know something, okay, we're not judging, you're back in the fold, you'll make up the minyan. At what point do we say, I don't know whether you did tshuva, you didn't do tshuva. How can we tell when someone who wants to come back has really come back? Very interesting question. Look at number 11. Meshumad shechazar bo. The kibel alav tshuva, and he's publicly accepted that he's now going back to Judaism and no longer wants to be, let's say, a Christian. Kosher miyad. That person, says the Rama, is immediately acceptable. We don't need him to do anything else. We take him at his word. Afal pisha lo asa adayim. Even though he hasn't yet, I don't know, been up to Misrad Apnim and changed his name back to Chaim Moshe. He's still called Christopher, you know, whatever. We take him at his word. Even though he hasn't yet done all the things that we hope he will do, we don't ask people to prove themselves. If they say they're doing tshuva, they did tshuva. The Shach, in number 12, on that particular halacha, brings mashma. It sounds like from the Ramah Daska b'mumala avodah zara, that's only for a convert, dina hachi, that is the halacha. Aval be'emet ze'eino. But really, that's not the case. This is not just a halacha in people who have converted, but this is a paradigm. This is a general principle in tshuva, that anyone who says that they're going to do tshuva, we take them at their word. Elatama de miyad shekibul sagi. Why is it enough? De mitzama yikayim. Because we assume that if this person has actually said publicly they're not going to be a Christian or whatever anymore, we assume they're going to fulfill that. And he brings a proof. Look at his proof. Shahari din zelamad marik mikohen. The marik, who was living in Europe in the 14th century when this was an issue as well, he learns it from a kohen. Shenasa nashim ba'aveira. What if a kohen married women that he's not allowed to marry? A Kohen married a divorcee. Is he allowed to serve in the Beit HaMikdash? Yes or no? No, he's not. He loses his kahuna rights. He married this woman. He should not have married this woman. But says there the halacha, the noider, he can make a public vow saying, I'm going to divorce this person. We're getting divorced. Don't worry. It was a big mistake. The oibed, and he can go off and do the avodah. He can serve in the Beit HaMikdash having made that vow. The yored, and he can come back, umagareish, and go through all the court proceeding. Meaning, we don't say to the Kohen, well, anyone can talk is cheap. Wait, let's see if you actually divorce her, and then we'll let you go to the Beit HaMikdash, we'll let you serve in the temple. No. We say to him, okay, you made a neder, you made a public vow, that you're gonna do the right thing. Fine, you can do what you do, and come back and divorce her later. But in case of the shach, b'chol momedin ahachi. And therefore, as far as I'm concerned, anybody, once they've actually committed to change their ways, then we should take them at their word. Just like this Cohen who said that he was going to divorce the woman, we let him serve, and then he can come back and divorce her. That's the sack of the shaft. What's that? Correct. It's not like whoever it was, he would have to divorce her. Now, the Rav Yonatan Eibershitz says, oh, come on. You know, we weren't born yesterday. Anyone can say anything. That's not good enough. He says, that's not a general principle. Number 13. He's astonished at the shach. He says, how can we just believe people? These are not just a regular person. This is a person who has a track record of having behaved badly. You know, if he went and did this and he stole or he did it, whatever, so he won't lie? Oh no, he stole money and he ran away with whoever knows who, but he wouldn't tell a lie. These people have no problem lying. Of course he's going to lie. We need to have something clear, concrete. We need to see they did tshuva, not just that they promised they were going to do tshuva. Ah, what about the Kohen that we said that he can just say he's going to divorce and then go and do the avoda? Why is that different? That's not good enough generally, but we require neider before. You have to make a vow. That's the point, you have to make a vow. Vows are very serious, isn't it? A public neider? Meaning, there are people who will marry a divorcee if they're a Kohen and then tell a lie, but they won't mess around with a vow. People take their vows very seriously, and that's why we trust him on the vow, but that's a neider, yes. Oh, good. So this was before that was the case. So that's an interesting question. At what point in a marriage which was never correct in the first place, when will we use a hetamei rabbonim and how will we? I'm not getting into that now. We had a whole bunch of shiram on agunas, if you remember that far back, when we had it. So he says the Kohen is a different case. Kumoshin is back, he lo nechshad bazeh. We're not worried he's going to break a vow. Vegam muma, and even an apostate, even a person who became a Christian, if they actually leave the Christian community and they come to us and say, I want to be Jewish again. So you know something? that's not good enough, because that's already risking their neck to come out in that way in the Middle Ages and go back and say, I want to go back and be Jewish. If they catch him, he's had it. That's it. Becoming Jewish again is going to be a death sentence for him. So he says, that we accept. And he's not going to be with them. So in the case of the Kohen, he makes a vow. That's good enough. In the case of the apostate, he does something which is really, you know, makes a commitment. He comes back. But in a case of a regular person, the rabbi, whoever it is, said, oh, I used to do this, I won't do it anymore. Like, I don't believe that. I don't accept that. And therefore, there's an interesting machlokas here between the Shach, who is more willing to accept people, and the Rabbi Yonatan Eidoshit. And the question is, how do you prove that you've done tshuva? It's a little bit difficult, isn't it? Because you don't want to put people right back into the same tempting circumstances as they were before, because that's the last thing. Someone was found guilty of stealing. So that now you make him the gabbai of the shul, the gabbai stocker of the shul, and we'll say, if you haven't stole money, then we'll see that you're not going to do that. So it's going to be very difficult. Added to which, there are certain kinds, and we'll see now the Shulchan Aruch recognizes this, there are certain kinds of behavior patterns which are actually addictive. And it's very, very hard to ever really do tshuva from them. I remember my wife was once talking to Rabbi Abraham Twersky, who of course works with a lot of addictive behavior and people who are trying to deal with that. And he said there are certain kinds of predatory behavior that it's just almost impossible to ever really say that the person is now over this and now they've got past this. Obviously this is a psychological and an issue that appropriately qualified people have to adjudicate, but there are some behaviors that they're different from others, and look at how the Shulchan Aruch deals with this. Number 14, Me'ematai chazarat ha-mesachakim bekubia, gamblers, mesachakim bekubia, people who play with dice. How do we know when they've done tshuva? Meaning, somebody who, I don't know, does something stupid one day, they can't resist, they go for a cheeseburger, and then they say, you know something, I lost my mind, I don't know why I did it, it was a stupid thing to do, I'll know, okay, you know something, how addictive can cheeseburgers be? But gambling, there's the shulchan, you don't have to answer that question, it's fine. You know, gambling, everyone knows, is an addictive behavior. And they knew even then. So when can we know that they're really over the gambling? Look at what he says. Mishayishmaru pastasehem, they have to smash their dice, okay? They have to smash up the stuff that they play, they gamble with. Clear tzot, these are the things that they play with. V'yachso behem chazara gemura shelo yaseh afilu b'chinam. And they have to actually commit that they won't ever gamble again, even for no money. They won't even gamble for, I don't know, Gary Nim or whatever it is. We need to see that there's a behavior pattern which is way to the other direction for us to believe that they ever really did tshuva. Similarly, Lamed Aleph in the middle of 14, Me'ematai chazarat mafriche yonim. What about people who do pigeon racing? Pigeon racing, mafriche yonim. The Gemara, the Mishnah talks about this. This is a big thing back in the day. And pigeon racing, what is the modern? People do greyhound, bet on the greyhound racing, horse racing. It's all the same kind of thing. And don't worry, because even though I lost the last 10, I'll make it all back on the next bet. Because, you know, people do that, right? So he says, how do we know that they're really over it? They have to smash the things that they use to catch the pigeons publicly. They won't even do it in the desert. Meaning they have to go to the opposite extreme. So the Shulchan Aruch recognizes that there are certain kinds of behavior which are called chimud mammon, where they, in this case, for money. And we have to take that into account as well when we're saying, oh, this person did tshuva. Well, tshuva from what? If we found him, you know, I don't know, he was speeding on the motorway and he lost his driver's license. Okay, so people do tshuva from that. That's not addictive behavior. They realize they behave badly. But other behavior is not the same, and therefore we have to take that into account. And sometimes a rabbi will not be able to just say sorry, because that's just not acceptable and that's not realistic. The last question before we look at the contemporary rulings is, should we ever reinstate people? Should we say, okay, you know, you were a Rosh Hashiva, you went to jail, now you can be a Rosh Hashiva again? So the Rambam apparently says, no, that's not acceptable. Meaning, maybe learning Torah from people again, if they really did tshuva, maybe yes, because there is such a thing as tshuva. But look at what he says in Hilchos Sanhedrin, number 16. Aval Rosh HaYeshiva. Now here he's talking about the Nasi of the Sanhedrin. He's not talking about any Rosh Yeshiva, but we'll see, maybe extends to that. Shechata. He sinned. Malkim Oto. He gets his punishment. if he needs Malchus, he gets his, he does his time, Ve'ein chozer l'sraruto. But he can't come back. There is no coming back. Because, why? So the number of commentators give different reasons. One reason he gives, which is given, is that if we put him back in charge of the Sanhedrin, he may take revenge on other people that, you know, shocked him, that told people that he did what he did. So that obviously is less of an issue with regular rabbis and Rosh Yeshiva. But other people say no, it's because he'll never really again command the respect of the people. Because even though he did tshuva, people are always going to talk. People are always going to say, oh, look, there's the one who, dot, dot, dot. And others say, and I think this is definitely the case in many situations, if a person in such a public position does those averas, it's just a chilul Hashem. And to put him back on the in his position is just another chilul Hashem. The whole thing is just a chilul Hashem, and therefore he can't be done in that way. But you see that there's a discussion on this, and people in our society who have been in situations of jail or whatever, who have gone back, obviously this has been discussed in different ways and come out with different answers. So let's have a look just in the last few minutes, I may finish a few minutes early, at some contemporary rulings which I think you'll find interesting. Rav Schechter. Rav Schechter, who of course is very involved as a poetic for the OU. So let's see what he says. So he is recorded here, there is an interesting sefer called, by David Lichtenstein, called Headlines. Okay? He brought out two versions of this, two volumes, volume one, volume two. It's very, I recommend it very strongly. David Lichtenstein is a very interesting fellow in America. I don't know him personally. I've listened to him. He has an interview radio show where he himself is a finance guy of some kind, and he does this because he believes in it. He wants to be married to Torah. It's not his paranoia. And he interviews all these really interesting people, and he asks them about these fascinating issues. And he has a number of interviews online, and he wrote these books. He asked Rav Schechter, can one still follow the Piskei Halach of a fallen rabbi? Actually, truth is, this is actually from Jewish Action. The next one is from David Lichtenstein, we'll see soon. So Rav Schechter says as follows. No, you cannot follow the psak of a fallen rabbi. He brings the Gemara in Moed Katan, says, according to the Torah, we may only follow a rabbi's ruling if he properly models Torah behavior. If he's about Aveira, he knowingly violates rabbinic laws, biblical laws, he's not qualified to teach. When members of the public become aware of his improper behavior, they may no longer rely on his judgment for any rulings unless it can be verified that the rulings were rendered before the rabbi's sinful conduct began. So here Rav Schechter, interestingly, does bring a distinction. He says that a psak that was given from earlier before the rabbi went off, you can continue to rely on. But any psak which is given after the rabbi went off is not possible to rely on. He says at the top of page 5, since it is often not possible to ascertain when these rulings were rendered, one should ask another rabbi for a new psak. And then he says an interesting thing. People use Jastrow's dictionary. What's Jastrow's dictionary? Anyone who's ever learned in yeshivas, where they, you know, Jastrow's dictionary is an invaluable aid to learning any kind of Gemara, you know, Talmud Bavli, Yerushalmi. Marcus Jastrow was a Reform rabbi, as far as I'm aware, who wrote a phenomenal dictionary on Aramaic to English. No one has yet surpassed him. Mike Sokolov in Harnoff wrote a fantastic dictionary as well, but it's not yet gained the same popularity that the Jastrow dictionary. I've learned in different yeshivas. Some yeshivas, the Jastrow dictionary is on top of the table. Some yeshivas, the Jastrow dictionary is underneath the table. Okay? Everyone to their own sensitivities. Okay? I've learned in yeshivas where even Rav Soloveitchik is under the table as well. But they will not learn him because it's Gevaldik. But that's another story, okay, which is not for now. So he says, although people use Jastrow's dictionary, and I was told that Jastrow is not orthodox, that is different because that's an issue of translation. Not psak. For a psak, a rabbi needs to consider all issues before him. It's very different than a mere translation, etc., etc. Question number 2. What should one do with a sforim written by such a rabbi? They should not be used. Interestingly. They since his sforim include his ideas and rulings, they fit into prohibitions against studying Torah from someone who is unfit due to his improper behavior. Anytime someone writes a sefer, he fleshes out and resolves apparently contradictory passages. The type of person we're discussing is not qualified to do this, etc. If it can be verified that the sforim and the rulings were issued before the person's sinful behavior began, only then can they be relied upon and quoted. And that's very difficult. Meaning, some behavior, it turns out, has been going on for years. It's just only come out now. How do I know? I'm thinking of one particular book by one particular rabbi who is now in jail in America, and it turns out that he'd been doing what he'd been doing for years. It just only got picked up recently. So
According to Rav Shechti, maybe that's not acceptable if we really can't tell. There's people like that all over the place. Rav Willick, let's look at Rav Willick. Rav Willick deals with some other issues which we haven't picked up on, and I think it's instructive to see. He was on with Rav Lichtenstein. Rav Shechter was in Jewish Action. Look at Rav Willick. Any indiscretion with respect to a riot, he says there are different kinds of indiscretion. If it turns out the rabbi has been sexually involved in misconduct, he said it is an absolute disqualification from serving a role in Torah education. When it comes to monetary matters, there are so many different levels of monetary violations. It's interesting, he draws that very strong distinction. When it comes to sexual impropriety, he's not interested in what went on. It's all completely invalidating. When it comes to money, okay, there's money. It depends on what the money is. And he's right, because it's not all the same. Not everything's the same. Okay? If we hear that some rabbi got the wrong change when he went to Berman's bakery, and then rather than, you know, going back, he left it in his pocket, that's also a Torah violation of a monetary prohibition. But I don't think anybody would suggest that we should now defrock that rabbi because he didn't give the change. Maybe he would. I don't know. But I hope not. So he knows the wrong thing to do. He said, it seems to me that a significant monetary violation is enough to disqualify a person. Now, it's hard to define significant precisely. As far as gaiva, arrogance, is concerned, it should certainly disqualify an individual. But it's hard to define the term a bal gaiva. I know quite a few rabbis who are into themselves a little bit.
Does that exist?
Gaiva dick. How does that work? Unfortunately, there are people with gaiva who sit comfortably with their seats in the world of Torah education and the rabbinate and have not been fired for the sin of gaiva. Not every instance of gaiva translates into misfeasance. Hubris often leads to misconduct, but not always. If you ask me, such an individual should not be a rabbi. But once he is a rabbi, it is hard to terminate him. I think he means terminate his employment. But I think we know what he means. I think we're going to bring in the Terminator to it. Can students learn from a rabbi's svarim after he's exposed as a sinner? He says, no. Rav Willig is very machmir on this. This kind of sinful behavior, he's talking here about the sexual impropriety, because this interview was just after the scandal that I alluded to before about this rabbi's very inappropriate behavior with women came into the public domain. It's so far from the proper standard, I believe that his forum, his Torah, his website, his Rosha should all be discarded. We should not be learning his Torah at all. Rabbi Meir was unique, and he goes on to talk about Rabbi Meir. And then he talks about the victims in this way. Tshuva is possible. But who said he did tshuva? Tshuva means he's contrite, asks forgiveness, he's sincere, not just bluffing, accepts upon himself different safeguards, etc. And even if he did tshuva, we need to balance the needs of the Baal Tshuva, which is significant, with the needs of the victim. It's impossible to give a one-size-fits-all answer. It depends on the nature of the sin, the nature of the perpetrator, the nature of the victim, the place where a Baal Tshuva's activities are taking place as compared to where the victim is. All of this needs to be taken into consideration. In other words, it has to be taken to an appropriate authority. Once a person is caught in illicit behavior with respect to women, I don't think he should be trusted on anything. I would say that nothing he said is reliable. Let's go over to the last page, and I'll show you a couple of things, and then we'll draw things to an end. It is very important, he says, for a person whose trust in a rav was broken, whether it's a man or a woman, to try and find a new rav from whom they can really trust. Going through life without any rav, with the feeling that every rav is a suspect, which sadly people have, and that's the Chilul Hashem. Because if he's up to it, then who knows what's with it. Even though everyone logically knows that just because one person does something does not mean, and will not mean, that everybody is doing similar things. Nevertheless, people feel hurt, and people are very strongly, you know, have a sense and a reality of being a victim. There are rotten apples in every barrel. Too many, unfortunately, but we cannot throw all the rabbis out just because of the unsavory, illicit, illegal, and horrific behavior exhibited by some. So he says you have to try and find, reinforce people's faith and confidence in the rabbinate, even though that's a critically difficult thing to do. And at the end, I brought you other different opinions as to whether a past misconduct has an impact on present, forum, etc., etc. I think we've done this topic quite comprehensively. Where have we left it? I think, you know, every case is a different case. Yes, sir? No, he doesn't mean that. He means if the misconduct was due to the kind of Yetzahara, which is bad behavior but is understandable because all of us have Yetzahara, we expected more from the rabbi, but he let us down, as opposed to fundamental evil victim-oriented behavior. I like the case, you know, the rabbi was in a rush, he parks his car badly, you know, he double parks, everyone goes crazy, there are 16 trucks peeping and waiting, and he's running in to get his car. That's the Yitzhara. He couldn't go down the road and park and pay and then walk 15 minutes, would probably be good for his health anyway, and walk back and back. That's a trivial one. He's talking about more, as opposed to misbehavior, which is predatory. We talked about that last week. Let's leave this topic. Yes, sir.
What about learning what the rabbi
said
in order to
use
it afterwards? For instance, you know, the rabbi was like,
yes, yes. Yes, maybe. But you have to be very careful before you go up against people like that, because they'll wipe the floor with you, because they're big time in the Chachomim. In that particular example, I don't think anybody in their right mind would have stood up and tried to debate, because they probably...
I'm talking about learning what the guy...
Oh, okay, fine. By the way, that person you alluded to is the one with the books on the table in the YU forum, in the academic section. So we'll leave it there. I will be away, sadly, for the next 3 weeks. I will be in America recruiting. I apologize. There will be people here who will be giving you, no doubt, wonderful shiurim. Please God, I will be back 3 weeks or 4 weeks, I suppose, from now. And I will be back away hopefully much after that. Maybe a week here and a week there. But it's recruiting season and we all have to hit the road. So I wish you a wonderful week and hope to see you soon.